hope went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Kingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will continue reading from Hearts West, True Stories of Mail-Order Brides on the Frontier. The author is Chris Enns, E-N-S-S, and this was published in 2005 by Two Dot Publishing in Guilford, Connecticut, and in Helena, Montana. And before we begin, I remind you that our stories are sometimes edited for recording. Our first story today deals with Rachel Bella Kahn and Abraham Kaloff, Northern Plains pioneer couple. The clump of yarn Rachel Bella Kahn was attempting to unravel was a mixture of complicated knots and tangles. The 17-year-old servant girl painstakingly worked through the mass of thick threads, rolling the straightened strands into a neat, tight ball. Chaya Kaloff, a graying older woman from Chvedkivka, Russia, watched the young woman's every move closely. After several moments, Rachel patiently and successfully transformed the snarled ball into a manageable skein. The ball of yarn was politely handed over to Chaya, who grinned from ear to ear. "Good," she told her. "Good. You've passed the test." The teenager breathed a sigh of relief. Chaya's approval was all that was standing in the way of Rachel's marriage to the North Dakota farmer seeking her hand. "A wife of good, strong character is what I seek, but it is optional. To be of the Jewish faith is mandatory," wrote Abraham Kaloff in 1892. Rachel, Bella, Kahn, fit all of the requirements set by the 22-year-old man. She was not the first to reply to his advertisement for a bride, nor was she the applicant Abraham had initially selected. Abraham's first mail-order bride choice reconsidered the proposal after her father persuaded her that America was too far away for her to move. Rachel had no such pull in her homeland and believed her sad existence could only improve in the United States. Once she was approved by Chaya, Abraham's sister, as a suitable candidate for a wife, Rachel eagerly looked forward to beginning a new life in the fertile farmland of North Dakota. Rachel Bella Kahn was born in 1876. Her mother died shortly after Rachel turned 4, leaving her and her 3 siblings to be raised by their father. A servant girl was hired to help Rachel's father in tending to the children, but the girl was cruel to Rachel and her brothers and sister, denying them food and beating them. Her father remarried when Rachel was 8. But his new wife proved to be just as abusive as the live-in help had been. Again, the Kahn children were made to go without many of the basic necessities of life and were physically mistreated as well. Rachel's father turned a deaf ear to his children's complaints of their stepmother's actions. The Kahn youngsters suffered through several years of cruelty. Rachel protected her family as best she could. According to her memoirs, her childhood passed on, slowly, in tears. At 17, Rachel went to work for her aunt as a maid. The job was a difficult one. She spent long hours cleaning the many rooms of her aunt's elaborate mansion, doing laundry, and shopping for the evening meals. Often, the shopping excursion included a trip to the butcher's shop. It was there that Rachel met and fell in love with the butcher's son. Her mother's side of the family, however, would not allow the two to pursue the relationship. They considered his occupation to be inferior and forbade them to see each other. Rachel celebrated her 18th birthday alone and with no prospects for the future. She was convinced she would die an old maid. A solicitation for marriage gave her a renewed hope that she could rise above her desperate situation. Abraham Kaloff liked what Rachel wrote about herself in a letter of response to his search for a wife. After exchanging photos and finding favor with one another's looks, Abraham commissioned his oldest sister to further interview his prospective bride. Chaya put Rachel through a series of strenuous tests that challenged her patience and her good manner. She won the critical woman over by not becoming frustrated or angry while unraveling the ball of tangled yarn. Chaya agreed that Abraham should marry Rachel and sent her on her way. Rachel made the journey to America, traveling first by train from Brest-Litovsk, Russia, to Hamburg, Germany, and then by ship to Ellis Island. She was sick for 20 of the 22 days at sea, but quickly forgot the discomfort the minute she saw Abraham for the first time. "There's my beloved," she told a girl sitting next to her once they arrived in New York. The engaged couple recognized each other from their photographs, and when their eyes met, they knew the bond would be forever. Rachel and Abraham traveled from Ellis Island by train to North Dakota. While en route, the pair got to know one another, and Abraham revealed his plans for the future. He wanted to follow in the footsteps of his father and brothers and file a homestead claim on a patch of North Dakota prairie land. Rachel happily imagined the home she and Abraham would have, and that thought alone brought her more pleasure than she had ever known in her life. Although Rachel instinctively knew the life of a pioneer woman would be difficult, she was not prepared for the display of hardship that greeted her upon her arrival in Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Abraham's parents, brothers, their wives, and children met the couple at the depot. Rachel was shocked by their appearance. They were dirty and dressed in rags. Their faces were weathered, and none of the men wore shoes. After the introductions were made, Rachel, Abraham, and the other members of the Kaloff family climbed aboard an ox sled wagon and took off for their homestead 20 miles from Devil's Lake. Rachel's spirits were further dampened once they reached the Kaloff's combined spread. Abraham stopped the ox team in front of one of the three tiny buildings spaced a mile apart from one another. Rachel's heart sank still lower. Their home was nothing more than a rustic 12-by-14-foot dirt floor shack. The interior was furnished with a bed, a table made out of wood slats, two benches, and a stove. Until Rachel and Abraham exchanged vows, they would share their place with Abraham's parents, one of his brother's wife, and their two children. Abraham saw the disappointment in Rachel's eyes. He knew the living situation was far from perfect, but believed the sacrifice would be worth it in time. He took his fiancée on long walks, not only to get to know her better, but to reassure her that these troubled times were only temporary. Rachel was encouraged by Abraham's promise that in time they would be on their own and happy. While Abraham worked the fields, Rachel tried to make things as comfortable as she could in the primitive dwelling. Her days were spent gathering fuel for fire and greens for the evening meals, drawing water from a nearby well, and molding lamps out of dried mud. In her leisure time, she and the other members of the Kaloff family made plans for her and Abraham's wedding. Rachel's memoirs are filled with tragic tales of frontier living. Her wedding day was one of the happiest times she experienced in those first few years of establishing a life on the rugged plains of North Dakota. The ceremony took place in November of 1894 and was held in the least populated Kaloff home. The room was decorated with wildflowers and corn husks. All of the Kaloffs were in attendance, as well as a pair of neighboring Jewish families. Abraham wore an ill-fitting black suit. Rachel was adorned in a wedding dress she had made herself out of yellow, blue, and white striped fabric. The music was provided by the Kaloff woman singing traditional wedding songs while the men kept time on tin plates. Jewish custom dictated that Rachel's eyes be hidden throughout the day so that she could shed tears in private. During the ceremony, her face was covered with a flour sack, and during the reception, her eyes were covered with a cloth blindfold. After the vows were exchanged, Abraham led his bride to a banquet table filled with various dishes of beans, rice, and chicken. Once the meal was over, the couple was presented with wedding gifts: a red felt tablecloth with green flowers, two chickens, and two short women's undershirts. Their wedding day was a festive occasion, but Rachel's joy turned to bitterness when she realized that they would not be spending their wedding night alone. In order to conserve the limited fuel the combined Khalaf families had, they would be forced to continue sharing their home with several other people and all of their livestock. Frustrated with the living arrangements, and irritated with the pungent smell from the chickens and the cattle, Rachel's first day of marriage ended with her crying herself to sleep. Abraham was determined to improve their lot. He worked long, hard hours in the field and tended to the animals. Rachel labored making bread, combing the prairie for mushrooms and other food, and milking the cows. The first winter they shared as man and wife was a cold, harsh one, but an early spring brought warmer temperatures and the glad news that they were expecting a child. When the time came, Abraham and his mother helped Rachel with the birth of the baby. They had a girl and named her Minnie. The infant was wrapped in scraps of Rachel's old shirt. The new parents were woefully lacking in material goods, but compensated for their poor conditions by showering the infant with affection. Abraham worked nonstop in the fields to turn out a living for his wife and daughter. Rachel strived to keep her baby and herself healthy through a string of tough harvest seasons. At the end of their fifth year of marriage, the Khalafs had welcomed another daughter and two sons into the world. Using the income from a successful wheat crop, Abraham built a larger home for his growing family. By the turn of the century, it seemed as though Abraham and Rachel were on their way to transforming their once struggling homestead into a prosperous venture. Abraham's wheat crop was the largest yet, and harvest time promised to be bountiful. The Khalafs would finally be able to do more than simply get by. They would see a profit from their labor. All hope for a reversal of fortune was dashed, however, when a sudden and fierce storm dumped hail and rain over the ripe fields. It hammered the wheat into the ground and washed away the grain. Many of the Khalaf's animals were killed, and their home was flooded. After praising God for sparing them, they lamented their loss for a short period and then began at once to rebuild. Many neighboring settlers were unable to rebound from the disaster, but Rachel, Abraham, and their children persevered. 4 years and three more children later, the Khalaf's farm had fully recovered from the effects of the tragic storm. By 1910, the Khalaf homestead had grown to many times the size of the original 160-acre parcel of land they had initially maintained. They were not only farming, but breaking and buying wild horses as well. They had earned a reputation in the territory for being tenacious, and they were respected for their dedication to their Jewish faith. Abraham introduced improvements in agricultural practices and marketing to new farmers on the scene, and he and Rachel helped build the first school in the area. The Khalaf's efforts were recognized by Presidents William Taft and Woodrow Wilson. The Khalaf's had 9 children together and were married for more than 50 years. After spending 23 of those years on their North Dakota farm, they pulled up stakes and relocated to St. Paul, Minnesota. Abraham settled into the dry goods business, and Rachel worked raising funds for a variety of charities. In 1936, she began writing her life's story. Rachel and Abraham both died from natural causes in their late 70s. Rachel called their marital and pioneer experience a life worth living. And now here's a story about another successful pioneer couple, Eleanor Pruitt and Clyde Stewart, the homesteader and the sheep rancher. It starts with a quote from Eleanor Pruitt Stewart's letter to a friend and former employer, Mrs. Coney, of July 16, 1910. "The thing I have done is to marry Mr. Stewart. It was such an inconsistent thing to do that I was ashamed to tell you. And, too, I was afraid you would think I didn't need your friendship and that I might desert you." Eleanor Pruitt's thick, gloved hands unfolded a newspaper advertisement and followed the words written across the page with her index finger. "Housekeeper cook wanted for respected landowner. Offering a good permanent home for the right party." The announcement, placed in a Colorado newspaper in April 1909, was submitted by Wyoming sheep rancher H. Clyde Stewart. Eleanor's soft eyes studied the name of the rancher for a moment. She said his name out loud a few times and decided it was a good, strong name. "A dependable name," she told herself as she refolded the advertisement and slid it into her pocket. She smoothed out the slight wrinkles in her blue gingham dress and shifted in her seat. She glanced nervously at the mantel clock in Boulder's Sunshine Mission, where she and her 2-year-old daughter, Jareen, lived. Clyde would soon be there to interview her. If all went well, she would be on her way to Wyoming within the week. Since the death of her husband, Emily Rupert, in 1905, Eleanor had dreamed of going west and becoming a homesteader. Responding to Clyde's proposition was her way of taking control of her destiny. Clyde Stewart entered the mission at the exact time they were scheduled to meet. He was a proud, confident man of Scottish descent, who Eleanor later bragged stood inspection admirably. They were quite impressed with one another. Eleanor thought his demeanor and accent were quite charming. Clyde, 10 years Eleanor's senior, found her to be a lovely lass with a delightful sense of humor. After a brief question-and-answer period, Eleanor was invited to join Clyde on his trip to Burnt Fork, Wyoming. Eleanor Pruitt's life had begun in Fort Smith, Arkansas in 1876. The oldest in a family of 9, she assumed responsibility for her siblings after her parents died. At 14, she was a high school student, caretaker of her brothers, and a part-time employee with the Transcontinental Railroad. She was very well read and enjoyed writing. At the age of 22, she married a man who gave her the chance to capitalize on her talent. He encouraged her writing and persuaded her to regularly contribute articles and short stories to the Kansas City Star. 4 years after she married the inspiring Emily Rupert, and only a few months after the birth of their daughter, he was killed in a train accident. With the notion of someday owning her own plot of land, Eleanor drifted west, taking jobs along the way as a cook and a laundress. In Denver, Colorado, Eleanor befriended Ida Coney and for a time worked preparing the aristocratic woman's meals and tending to her home. Although she and her young daughter were fond of Mrs. Coney, Eleanor was not content to stay in Denver. While in town one day, loading up on supplies, she overheard 2 men discussing land in Wyoming available for homesteading. The conversation gave her incentive to continue pursuing her life's ambition, and in February of 1909, she wrote in her journal, "Nothing but the mountains, the pines, and the clean, fresh air seemed worthwhile. I want a homestead, one under my own name." Eleanor began at once making plans to fulfill her dream. The pastor of her church discouraged her from making the journey to Wyoming alone. He persuaded her to answer Clyde's ad, arguing the need to align herself with someone who already knew the territory and who could give her sound advice. It was a sensitive request, and she complied. Eleanor, Jareen, and Clyde arrived in Wyoming in April of 1909. It took 3 days traveling by train and stage to reach their destination. The stage ride over rough terrain was uncomfortable, and the road leading to Burnt Fork was covered in melting snow and mud. As soon as Eleanor and her daughter were settled in at the Stewart Ranch, she sat down to write Mrs. Coney to assure her of their safety. "At last we arrived, and everything is just lovely for me. I have a very, very comfortable situation, and Mr. Stewart is absolutely no trouble, for as soon as he has his meals, he retires to his room and plays on his bagpipes, only he calls it his bug peep. There's a saddle horse especially for me, and a little shotgun with which I am to kill sage chickens. We are between two trout streams, so you can think of me as being happy when the snow is through melting and the water gets clear. Jerrine is making good use of all of the good things we are having. She rides the pony to water every day. I have not filed on my land yet, because the snow is 15 feet deep on it, and I think I would rather see what I am getting, so I will wait until summer. They have just 3 seasons here, winter, July, and August. We are to plant our garden the last day of May. When it is so I can get around, I will see about land and find out all I can and tell you. Eleanor Pruitt Rupert, April 18, 1909. In May 1909, Eleanor laid claim to a homestead, filing on land adjoining Clyde's. The two worked their plots, mowing and stacking hay, planting gardens, and tending to the livestock. When she wasn't busy managing the farm and cooking, Eleanor and Jerrine would saddle a pony and ride across the hills surrounding the property. Mother and daughter followed renegade streams into the mountains, chased clouds in the big sky, and basked in the glorious colors and beautiful sunsets. Eleanor had never known such happiness. Any woman who can stand her own company can see the beauty of the sunset, loves growing things, and is willing to put in as much time at careful labor as she does over the washtub, will certainly succeed, will have independence, plenty to eat all the time, and a home of her own in the end. Eleanor Pruitt Rupert, January 23, 1913. Within 6 weeks of her stay at Clyde's, the two had fallen in love and married. She did not regret the short engagement or the hasty wedding. The demands of caring for the ranch necessitated the quick nuptials. As she wrote in a 1912 letter to Ida Coney, "Between planting the oats and other work that must be done early, Wyoming ranchers can scarcely take time even to be married in the springtime." In that same letter, written 2 years after the couple had married, Eleanor shared the events leading up to her wedding. "I have often wished I might tell you all about my Clyde, but have not because of 2 things. One is that I could not even begin without telling you what a good man he is, and I didn't want you to think I could do nothing but brag. The other reason is the haste I married in. The license was sent for by mail, and as soon as it came, Mr. Stewart saddled Chubb and went down to the house of Mr. Pearson, the justice of the peace and a friend of long standing. I'd never met any of the family, and naturally rather dreaded to have them come, but Mr. Stewart was firm in wanting to be married at home. So he told Mr. Pearson he wanted him and his family to come up the following Wednesday and serve papers on the woman of the house. They were astonished, of course, but being such good friends, they promised him all the assistance they could render. They are quite the dearest, most interesting family. I have since learned to love them as my own. Well, there was no time to make wedding clothes, so I had to do up what I did have. Isn't it queer how sometimes, do what you can, work will keep getting in the way until you can't get anything done? That's how it was with me those few days before the wedding, so much so that when Wednesday dawned, everything was topsy-turvy, and I had a very strong desire to run away. But I always did hate a piker, so I stood pat. Well, I had most of the dinner cooked, but it kept me hustling to get the house into anything like decent order before the old dog barked, and I knew my moments of liberty were limited. It was blowing a perfect hurricane and snowing like midwinter. I had bought a beautiful pair of shoes to wear on that day, but my vanity had squeezed my feet a little, so while I was so busy at work I kept on a worn old pair, intending to put on the new ones later. But when the Pearsons drove up, All I thought about was getting them into the house where there was a fire, so I forgot all about the old shoes and the apron I wore. I had only been here 6 weeks then and was a stranger. That's why I had no one to help me and was so confused and hurried. As soon as the newcomers were warm, Mr. Stewart told me that I'd better come over by him and stand up. It was a large room I had to cross, and how I did it before all those strange eyes I never knew. All I can remember very distinctly is hearing Mr. Stewart saying, "I will," and myself chiming in that I would, too. Happening to glance down, I saw that I'd forgotten to take off my apron or my old shoes, but just then Mr. Pearson pronounced us man and wife, and as I had dinner to serve right away, I had no time to worry over my odd toilette. Eleanor Pruitt Stewart, December 2, 1912. According to Eleanor's letters to Ida, the Stewarts lived a quiet but idyllic life in their home among the Blue Mountains. Eleanor wrote her friend that when she thought of all she had to be thankful for, she could scarcely crowd her joy into one short life. The Stewarts knew tragedy as well as joy, however, and Eleanor held the family together through those difficult times with unwavering courage. Clyde and Eleanor's first son was born a year after they were married, but died of erysipelas, an acute disease of the skin, a few months later. Eleanor's letter to Ida reflected the grace with which she accepted the hardship. "I held him in my arms till the last agony was over. Then I dressed the beautiful little body for the grave. Clyde is a carpenter, so I wanted him to make the little coffin. He did it every bit, and I lined and padded it, trimmed and covered it. Not that we couldn't afford to buy one, or that our neighbors were not all that was kind and willing, but because it was a sad pleasure to do everything for our little firstborn ourselves. As there had been no physician to help, so there was no minister to comfort, and I could not bear to let our baby leave the world without leaving any message to a community that sadly needed it. His little message to us had been love, so I selected a chapter from John, and we had a funeral service, at which all our neighbors for 30 miles around were present. So, you see, our union is sealed by love and welded by a great sorrow." Eleanor Pruitt Stewart, December 2, 1912. Eleanor gave Clyde 3 more sons, and all grew to be fine men. The Stewarts were married for 24 years. Throughout the first 4 years of their marriage, Eleanor corresponded with Ida Coney, sharing with her the adventures of a woman homesteader. In 1913, those letters were bound in a published book, Letters of a Woman Homesteader. In 1926, Eleanor suffered a serious injury while she was out stacking hay. A covey of quail flew in front of their horse-drawn mower that she was driving. The horses spooked and bolted, and in the process tossed her in front of the machine. She never fully recovered from the accident, and subsequently died in 1933. She was 57 years old. Now we shall read about the Red Stocking Snoozers. A cold Sierra wind blew past the lace-curtained window of a quaint Victorian home overlooking the lush Nevada City, California terrain. Inside, 3 elegantly dressed ladies sat fireside, sipping tea and discussing the rough elements who lived and worked in the town's mining camps. It was 1878, and the hills around the gold country were filled with unattached, rambunctious prospectors. Once the sun had set, and they could no longer work their claims, they made their way to the saloons to drink away their free time. Refined females considered such behavior to be an abomination and the source of great trouble. The proper ladies at the tea party believed the love of a good woman could deter coarse miners from these depraved activities and bring about civility in their community. Taking a cue from other frontier entrepreneurs, the women decided to make a written appeal to single females in the East to come to the West. With the abundance of available men in the region, The ladies were hopeful numerous matches would be made. Several obstacles needed to be overcome, however, before such a venture could be launched. Lack of funding to support such a grand endeavor would be a major hurdle, but first there was a local group that needed to be dealt with before any potential brides arrived. Young bachelors in the area had organized a secret society whose principal object was the suppression of the female sex. Members of the newly organized T-Trio Society recognized the necessity of disbanding the Bachelor Society, and plans were made to bring about its demise. They sought out a young reporter with a local newspaper and, promising the timid man a bride of his own, asked him to join the Bachelor's secret club and publish his findings. In case he should meet with an untimely death, the ladies promised to defray the expense of his funeral. The eager young man set to work and made inquiries of those suspected of being members of the group. After tackling half a dozen, one society bachelor willing to share information with the reporter was found. The gentleman wasn't an inducted part of the organization yet, but he had a friend who was. The friend agreed to submit the reporter's name to the group, and if he was accepted, his initiation would follow that very night. The following article, written by the journalist about his experience, appeared in the Nevada County newspaper, The Daily Transcript. My application was favorably received at the next regular meeting. I'd gone to bed. It was 11:30 p.m. when I was informed by the committee of my success and led to the place of the meeting in the bushes halfway up the north side of Sugarloaf. I was blindfolded, and the initiation ceremony was most peculiar. Finally, the bandage, a lady's lace handkerchief, was removed in response to an order like this: "Proclaim the fact of his redemption, and let the blind behold." The sight that met this reporter's eyes cannot be adequately described. The members sat in a circle on the ground. In the absence of President Mike Garver, Jerry Payne was called onto the chair, or rather a boulder, which answered the same purpose. Joe Fleming and George Stewart were hanging onto a monstrous banner to keep it from being blown over by the breeze. On this banner was inscribed the name of the order, the Red Stocking Snoozers. Am Lord, Dex Ridley, and L. Sukeforth were taking turns throwing wood upon the campfire that illumined the mysterious scene, and at the same time discussing topics of general interest, such as the new style of fall bonnets, etc. The two Fulweiler brothers were playing 7-up with the queens left out of the pack. M. Rosenberg and H. Hirschman had been stationed one on the summit and the other at the foot of Sugarloaf to give warning of approaching danger. Among other names proposed for membership during the evening were those of Walter Vinton, Fred Searles, and Archie Nivens. George Hentz moved that the applications be allowed to remain over for 1 month. Hentz seconded his own motion. It was put to a vote and carried unanimously. Everything was going along smoothly until Am Lord discovered the president pro tem wearing a white vest and mauve-colored necktie. This created a suspicion among the members that Jerry's faith was weakening. He saw the storm brewing, and rising, began to speak. In a few well-chosen words, he sharply criticized former members who had, for years, shared the benefits of this society and had basely deserted it, seeming, he added, to embrace the first opportunity, a woman. "I call the gentleman to order," hastily interrupted John Bacigalupi. "If the president knows anything, he knows that according to the Constitution, the name of woman, that is female, of course you understand, the other sex of our species, is not to be spoken of or about on such an occasion as this." The president glared upon the crowd, and singling out Cy Jackson, who lately joined and was extremely bashful, fastened his eye upon him and said sternly, "Sit down." "Go to thunder," was the prompt response. Charlie Fulweiler smiled approvingly. but detecting the president looking at him with considerable austerity, squirmed so that he put his feet in the hat of Jesse Holcomb, who had dropped in a friendly sort of way. "Now, gentlemen, what I want to say is this," said H. Hirschman, who'd left his post at the foot of the hill to join the conclave. "We need a higher level of discipline in our organization. We need, so to speak, a sort of Spartan firmness. We need..."
"You'll need to get your lives insured before we get through with you," shrieked a female voice a short distance away. "Give me the club, Sarah. Oh, give me it, quick."
There was the sound of rushing skirts through the bushes. The meeting adjourned in confusion, and the members scattered in every direction. The guards had been negligent in their duties, and when the indignant tea trio reached the scene of the Red Stocking deliberations, there wasn't a young man to be found. Harris Longfield, March 3, 1878. There's no historical information available to indicate that the Red Stocking snoozers continued to get together after their encounter with the tea trio. The trio did continue to meet, but shifted their focus from matchmaking to raising funds for orphans. Our final story this week is Eliza Farnham, the dedicated sponsor. This is a quote from Horace Greeley, newspaper man, April 12, 1849. "The mission is a good one, and the projector deserves success. The enterprise in which Mrs. Farnham has engaged is one which evinces much moral courage. Her reward will be found in the blessings which your countrymen will invoke for her when the vessel in which the association is to sail have arrived in California with her precious cargo. May favoring gales attend the good ship Angelique." Eliza Farnham stepped off the spacious packet ship Angelique, docked in the San Francisco harbor, and scanned the bustling seaside city with a smile. The pier was lined with curious, enthusiastic men, waiting to introduce themselves to the more than 200 young ladies who had replied to Eliza's ad seeking marriageable women to accompany her to the West. Taking the hand of each of her young sons, she proceeded proudly down the gangplank. All eyes were on the thin, bespectacled author and lecturer, on her intelligent, deep-set eyes, and her dark hair arranged in prim ringlets around her face. She stopped and waited for her charges to disembark. Just three ladies, who dared to take the trip across the ocean, followed after Eliza. The happy expressions the hopeful men wore were at once replaced with disappointed sneers. Lonely miners, who had come to California seeking a fortune in gold in 1849, were eagerly looking forward to seeing members of the opposite sex. Men outnumbered women on the emerging frontier by more than 12-1. When news of Eliza's trip to the gold country reached their desperate ears, they believed she would be bringing 10,000 eligible ladies with her. Disgruntled pioneers from every profession took to the saloons to drink away their dreams of finding a wife among Eliza's few recruits. The streets were soon filled with intoxicated men, using their fists to work out their frustrations. Miner Dashiell Greech reported of the scene, "I verily believe there was more drunkenness, more gambling, more fighting, and more everything that was bad that night than ever before occurred in San Francisco within any similar space of time." It was precisely this volatile, dissolute way of life that Eliza sought to correct. She believed the gentling influence of good women could bring positive, lasting changes for Western pioneers and miners, and could help tame the Wild West in the process. Many notable historians described her at the time as a woman bent on doing the world as much good as possible. Born on November 17, 1815, in Rensselaerville, New York, Eliza Woodson Burhans was raised by an overbearing aunt and a drunkard uncle. Her mother passed away when she was 5, and she never knew her father. Her upbringing was strict and troubled, plagued with abuse and neglect. She managed to rise above her struggles, however, finding solace in her schoolwork as well as in books by Voltaire and Thomas Paine. In 1835, at the age of 20, Eliza made her first trip west, traveling over the Santa Cruz Mountains in a buggy. The trip was grueling, but exhilarating for the young woman who gained strength in the beauty of the open country. She had read about the spacious landscape of the western frontier and wanted to see the unsettled prairie firsthand. She considered the new territory a wholly honest place where mankind could push the boundaries of all he believed possible in himself and in his world. Upon her return from her adventures out west, she moved to Illinois to live with her sister and brother-in-law. It was there, in the prairie state, that she met a young New England lawyer named Thomas Jefferson Farnham. After a brief courtship, the pair married in the fall of 1836. Eliza, who never saw herself as attractive, was transformed by Thomas's love. "I never imagined myself clothed with external splendor or gifted with beauty until approving eyes gazed upon me," she wrote. Thomas moved his new bride into a quaint two-room cottage and presented her with a chestnut pony as a wedding gift. For a while, they were blissfully happy. In 1838, she gave birth to their first son, but the following year, the couple watched him suffer with yellow fever and die. The disease also took her sister's life. She buried the pair together. "It is a devastating time," she wrote. "My sister is gone, and my boy. His little coffin seemed to carry my very heart into the earth with it." Thomas mourned the loss by taking a job as leader of an emigrant party heading to Oregon. Eliza remained behind, pouring her sorrows out on paper. She traveled throughout Illinois by stagecoach, compiling notes for a book she hoped to one day write. Not long after Thomas returned from his overland trek, he moved his wife east to New York. He wrote extensively about his trip across the frontier, and by 1846 had published 4 guidebooks. After giving Thomas 2 more sons, Eliza realized her dreams of seeing her own work in print. Her first manuscript, published in 1843, focused on what she called a woman's moral and spiritual superiority. Her subsequent work centered on the same theme, pondering the importance of a woman's role as a civilizer in frontier society. Her profound declarations and ideas shocked most readers, generated attention from politicians, and prompted a job offer from the Sing Sing prison, where she was invited to serve as jail matron for the women's section. Eliza was 27 when she accepted the position at Sing Sing and set about immediately to change the cruel ways in which female inmates were treated. She brought the establishment out of its dark age, where harsh fire-and-brimstone religiosity was practiced, and into a new era, where prisoners were supplied with books and taught to read. Feeling restless and increasingly resentful of Eliza's popularity as a reformer, Thomas went west again in 1847. A year later, while visiting San Francisco, he fell ill and died from complications of pneumonia. Once Eliza heard of Thomas's death, she left at once for California. With her arms around her sons, 9-year-old Charles and 11-year-old Edward, Eliza walked through the muddy, unpaved San Francisco streets toward the mortuary. Rowdy men filled every thoroughfare, parading from gaudy gambling house to gaudy saloon and back again like ants. Bawdy music spilled out of windows and doors of the bars, and guns fired at all hours of the night. Eliza drank in what she deemed a wild, depraved scene, the reckless abandon of a city raging with gold rush fever. The lack of women in this rambunctious setting did not escape her attention. She was one of a handful of females in the gold country, and wherever she went, men stared at her. "Doorways filled instantly," she wrote. "Little islands in the street were thronged with men who seemed to gather in a moment and who remained immovable until I passed. Recalling her belief that women were civilizers in a frontier society, a plan began to take shape. If this rugged area were to be reformed, it would take women to bring that change about, she later wrote. After a short rest, Eliza began the journey back to the East Coast with the idea to petition single women to move to California as checks upon the many evils there. On February 2, 1849, Eliza drafted an advertisement to be published in New York papers that explained her intentions. It is proposed that the company shall consist of persons not under 25 years of age, who shall bring from their clergyman, or some authority of the town where they reside, satisfactory testimonials of education, character, capacity, etc., and who can contribute the sum of $250 to help defray the expenses of the voyage, make suitable provision for their accommodation after reaching San Francisco until they shall be able to enter upon some occupation for their support, and create a fund to be held in reserve for the relief of any who may be ill or otherwise need aid before they are able to provide for themselves. To give her advertisement an air of respectability and authority she hoped would further attract prospective brides, she further secured endorsements from leading political figures like Horace Greeley, William Cullen Bryant, and Henry Ward Beecher. More than 200 ladies responded to Eliza's broadside, but a sudden illness kept her from being able to actively organize the expedition. In the end, only a handful of brides-to-be agreed to go to California with her. Eliza and her entourage set sail on April 15, 1849. The trip was widely publicized in frontier newspapers. Lonely miners eagerly anticipated the arrival of the packet ship Angelique, hoping to find a wife among its gentle freight. Some men, such as miner Henry Holmes, made mention of the forthcoming event in their daily journals. "Went to church three times today," Holmes reported. "A few ladies present. Does my eye good to see a woman once more. Hope Mrs. Farnham will bring 10,000. Not everyone found the idea of supplying single pioneers with potential brides acceptable. Many socialites considered it a scandalous plan, and the campaign was mired in controversy. Rumors that Eliza was little more than a procurer ultimately kept many women from committing to the journey. The highly anticipated trip to San Francisco was troublesome from the start. Eliza challenged the authority of the ship's captain, demanding he make an unscheduled stop for fresh water. Furious with what he referred to as a brazen female meddler, the captain lured Eliza and her chargers off the ship in Chile and left them stranded there. A long, anxious month passed before they were able to catch another ship for San Francisco. Eliza and her boys arrived at their new home in Santa Cruz in February of 1850, and from there they proceeded to find the land that had been left to them. After a short carriage ride through the country, the three arrived at the homestead. The house was little more than a shack, but the acreage around it was lush and filled with cattle. "An ideal place to raise a family," she would later write in her book, California, Indoors and Out. With the help of her good friend, Georgiana Bruce Kirby, the two built a ranch house on the property and began farming the land. Realizing their long, full dresses hampered their work in the fields, Eliza decided the two needed to wear bloomers. She made their wide, loose pants from old gymnastic suits. Like her mail-order bride plan, it was another unconventional action that shocked the community around her. In 1852, Eliza accepted a marriage proposal from San Francisco resident and entrepreneur William Alexander Fitzpatrick. According to Georgiana's journal, William was the greatest blackguard in the country. He frequently mistreated Eliza, and their life was a series of stormy partings and reconciliations. The two divorced 4 years later. In 1856, Eliza abandoned ranch life and returned to her work at state women's prisons, speaking out for reform. She eventually took a job as principal of the first Santa Cruz public school. In her leisure time, she toured the state, lecturing on topics ranging from spiritualism to women's rights. She penned 4 books on the subject of women in the emerging West. In 1859, she organized a society to assist destitute women in finding homes in the West and took charge of several such emigrant parties. "None but the pure and strong-hearted of my sex should come alone to this land," she reasoned. Historian Herbert Bancroft boasted that Eliza was one of the first women to recognize the effects her sex could have on the Wild West, and probably one to be avoided at all costs by the hell-raising male populations in the California gold rush fields. Her efforts convinced like-minded female pioneers to relocate and to cast their influence over the new frontier. This is a quote from the California Daily Alta in 1849. "This is the most gladdening intelligence of the day. Eliza Farnham and her girls are coming, and the dawning of brighter days for our golden land is even now perceptible. The day of regeneration is nigh on hand. We shall prepare ourselves to witness the great change which is shortly to follow with feelings akin to hilarious joy." Eliza Farnham's unconventional methods of bringing civility to the Wild West helped transform the frontier and make the emerging country fit for wives and family. And I was actually able to find online a copy of the broadside that Eliza had published, encouraging young women to join her in her trek west. This broadside starts out, "Ship Angelique, California Association of American Women, New York, February 2, 1849. The death of my husband, Thomas J. Farnham, Esquire, at San Francisco, in September last, renders it expedient that I should visit California during the coming season. Having a desire to accomplish some greater good by my journey thither than to give the necessary attention to my private affairs, and believing that the presence of women would be one of the surest checks upon many of the evils that are apprehended there, I had desired to ask attention to the following sketch of a plan for organizing a party of such persons to emigrate to that country. Among the many privations and deteriorating influences to which the thousands who are flocking thither will be subjected, one of the greatest is the absence of woman, with all her kindly cares and powers, so peculiarly conservative to man under such circumstances. It would exceed the limits of this circular to hint at the benefits that would flow to the growing population of that wonderful region from the introduction among them of intelligent, virtuous, and efficient women. Of such only, it is proposed to make up this company. It is believed that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of such females in our country, who are not bound by any tie that would hold them here, who might, by going thither, have the satisfaction of employing themselves greatly to the benefit and advantage of those who are there, and at the same time of serving their own interest more effectually than by following any employment that offers to them there. It is proposed that the company shall consist of persons not under 25 years of age, who shall bring from their clergyman, or some authority of the town where they reside, satisfactory testimonials of education, character, capacity, etc., and who can contribute the sum of $250 to defray the expenses of the voyage, make suitable provision for their accommodation after reaching San Francisco, until they shall be able to enter upon some occupation for their support, and create a fund to be held in reserve for the relief of any who may be ill or otherwise need aid before they are able to provide for themselves. It is believed that such an arrangement, with 100 or 130 persons, would enable the company to purchase or charter a vessel and fit it up with everything necessary to comfort on the voyage, and that the combination of all for the support of each would give such security, both as to health, person, and character, as would remove all reasonable hesitation from the minds of those who may be disposed and able to join upon such a mission. It is intended that the party shall include 6 or 8 respectable married men and their families. Those who desire further information will receive it by calling on the subscriber at Eliza M. Farnham. That's followed by a note at the bottom of the broadside. The New York-built packet ship Angelique has been engaged to take out this association. She is a spacious vessel, fitted with staterooms throughout and berths of good size, well ventilated, and provided in every way to secure a safe, speedy, and comfortable voyage. She will be ready to sail from New York about the 12th or 15th of April. We, the undersigned, having been made acquainted with the plan proposed by Mrs. Farnham in the above circular, hereby express our approbation of the same, and recommend her to those who may be disposed to unite with her in it, as worthy the trust and confidence necessary to its successful conduct. And this was then signed by numerous esteemed persons, including Horace Greeley, the American newspaper editor and publisher, who is the founder and editor of the New York Tribune, William Cullen Bryant, the American romantic poet, journalist, and longtime editor of the New York Evening Post, and Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who is an American Congregationalist clergyman, social reformer, and speaker, primarily known for his support for the abolition of slavery. And that concludes our readings today from Hearts West, True Stories of Mail Order Brides on the Frontier, all written by our author, Chris Enns. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky. And up the cloudy draw, hi-yay-yip-y-i-ho.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.